For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
Labor strikes against France's controversial pension reform appear to be waning. Walkouts are over at several oil refineries, where weeks of protests and blockades disrupted gas supplies and other services across the country. But despite fierce opposition from France's unions, Parliament is siding with President Nicolas Sarkozy in upping the retirement age by 2 years. Tariq Aziz, known as the international face of the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq, is sentenced to death by hanging today. A spokesman for the Iraqi High Tribunal said Aziz would be executed for his role in the persecution of Shiites. The 74-year-old defendant sat alone in the courtroom today, head bowed, as the judge announced the verdict. It's uncertain when Aziz will be put to death, but he has 30 days to appeal. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Neurologist Oliver Sacks is famous for his case studies of patients with unusual perceptual problems. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Sacks about his new book, which covers visual disorders, including two of his own, face blindness, which prevents him from recognizing faces, and a tumor in his right eye that created visual distortions and hallucinations. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. Next week, people all over the country will be going to the polls to vote for their choices to lead their state governments and also to represent them in Washington. We also know at the same time, a lot of other people won't be voting at all. So what is it that makes a difference? Why is it that there are some people who are passionately engaged in politics, and there are others who simply pay no attention? This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will look at some of the connections between personality and political involvement. And our guest is Jeffrey Mondak. He is the James M. Benson Chair in Public Issues and Civic Leadership in the Department of Political Science here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. This is a question that he has been looking at in his research for a number of years. And if you'd like to read in some detail what he has learned, you might look for a book that he's authored. It's titled Personality and the Foundations of Political Behavior. And it is published by Cambridge University Press and goes into some detail in this subject, looking at this basic sort of question, well, are there ways in which our personalities influence whether we're going to be involved or not? And maybe also would influence our political orientation along that liberal conservative spectrum. We'll talk about some of that in this part of Focus. Of course, questions are welcome. Questions are always welcome. We hope people will be on target with the topic and will be brief so we can keep moving. But questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And email as well. If you'd like to send in your question that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me in.
There's an interesting story here that you tell sort of early on in the book about earlier in your career as a political scientist. You were talking with someone who was a more senior political scientist about your ideas, and you started talking about psychology. And immediately this person cut you off. And what was it that he said?
He said, psychology is about aberrant individual-level behavior. It has nothing to do with politics.
And you thought, well, that's kind of bizarre. And I sort of thought so, too. That assertion that says psychology has nothing to do with politics, it sort of makes your jaw drop because I guess I sort of think as a layperson, well, psychology has everything to do with politics.
I thought so, too. The awkward part for me, I was still a graduate student finishing up, and it was my second job interview ever for a position as a professor, and he was a very senior political economist, and so his approach to politics was an economic one, and we just didn't see eye to eye.
Yeah. And I suppose that says that traditionally within political science, when people looked at this question, well, how do people vote? Why do they vote? Are they involved? They looked at all sorts of things about that individual. But the question of their personality was just not part of the analysis.
It typically was not. There was some early work a long time ago, 1940s, 50s, on personality and politics, and then it fell out of favor, and we mostly looked at what I would call situational or environmental variables. So we looked at the circumstances of a person's life and tried to see if that determined whether he or she voted or was a liberal or a conservative, not whether there was something more intrinsic to the person, such as personality traits.
Yeah. It seems to be such a reasonable idea, at least something worth thinking about, that that something as basic as the person's personality would – you're not arguing – nobody would argue that's 100% determinism kind of thing. But the idea that that would contribute seems to be pretty fundamental sort of idea, and yet for such a long time it was just not – at least people in political science just didn't do that.
Well, and part of the problem, I think a lot of political scientists, political psychologists like myself, had it in the back of their minds that personality may matter. One of the problems that they had run into was that the study of personality within the field of psychology had kind of gotten stuck in a rut for a while. There are a whole lot of personality traits. And so trying to figure out which traits you ought to be studying is very difficult to do. Somewhere in the mid to late 1980s into the early 1990s, psychologists began developing a consensus that there were five core traits that capture a lot of what we mean by personality. That, once that model emerged, that made it much easier for people like me to come in and apply it in areas like the study of politics.
Yeah. So we can – well, maybe we should just go on and talk about that because it's your sort of your fundamental structure that you're using to talk about personality, and it's a way to try to make things a little simpler and maybe more quantifiable when you talk about, well, what do you mean by personality and what aspects are you interested in?
Right. And so the model that the psychologist began developing, and this was empirically derived. So what they had done was they'd gathered a lot of data from a lot of people and a lot of personality traits and tried to find out, were there any consistent dimensions that kept coming up? And they found study after study that there were five core different personality trait dimensions that emerge among different people at different times across cultures all across the world. And we use the acronym OCEAN to summarize them. The O is for openness to experience. The C is conscientiousness. The E is extroversion. The A is agreeableness, and then the N is neuroticism, and I usually call it by its opposite, which is emotional stability.
Mm-hmm. And the basic idea here, sort of apart from politics, the basic idea here is that there is some sense in which we are born, virtually born, with predispositions on all of these things.
Yeah, that's a very important point. People who study the genetic basis of human behavior talk about the level of heritability of a phenomenon. They use twin studies. They use actual analyses of genes, genome-wide studies, to try to determine how much of any given phenomenon is genetically encoded, how much of it is heritable as opposed to environmentally shaped. On the high end, things like height, variance in height across a population is about 80% heritable, and so it's written into your genes. What we find with personality traits is that at least 50% of the variance across a population in their personality traits and as much as 60 to 80% of the variation in personality traits is genetically based, is biologically based. And so, yes, you are born with these general tendencies And that part, which is environmentally shaped, happens very early on in life. And so by the time you're a voter, by the time you're 18, 20, voting in an election, your personality is pretty well set.
Yeah. So we're certainly not discounting environment and life experience. That's certainly a big part of this too. But what you're hardwired with is also a big – so we're saying roughly about a 50-50 kind of a –
In terms of personality, yes, at least 50% of your of the variation in your personality traits comes from biological sources.
So then as far as I'm sure people wonder about, well, when is when do these attitudes get set so that they may be set fairly early so that you can't ask a two-year-old, are you a liberal or a conservative, but that you might be able to make some kind of prediction about when that 2-year-old or 6-year-old or whatever you pick gets to be 18, 19, 20, how they're going to think about things.
Yeah, there's some political scientists who are actually looking at the physiological, the biological basis of political behavior. And one of the things that they find, and it ties in very nicely with my work, is that in terms of ideology, your question, conservatives exhibit a physiological tendency to be more attentive to risks. They are aware of threats. They're concerned with threats. And then liberals are less attentive to and aware of threats. And so that doesn't sound like it's political at all, but it is something that – they find that there are brain functions that physically differ between people who are liberal and conservative that correspond with how risk attentive you are, and that ultimately that behavior predicts whether you call yourself a liberal or a conservative.
Yeah. So this is very interesting. I'm sure that people would think that, you know, would wonder, well, you know, how much difference really is there between the attitudes of a person, say, in their 20s and the attitudes of that person when they're in their 50s? This would seem to suggest that maybe there may not be a great deal of difference, but that you don't just look at say, well, maybe by the time you're in your late adolescence, things are sort of set. This would suggest that those patterns are set much earlier.
Well, there are characteristic life cycle changes. So if you look at any group of 10-year-olds, some of them will be more agreeable and some will be more disagreeable. Some will be more calm. Some will be more nervous. If you look at them again when they're 40 or 50, they probably all will be a little bit more agreeable and a little bit more calm than they were when they were 10. But the difference between them will still exist. The calmest at 10 will still be the calmest at 50. Mm-hmm.
You would think, though, that there would be that, say, people's life experiences at certain points when they really first go out into the work world, perhaps when they have a partner and when they first have children, when they get older and they start thinking about retirement, that at different points in your life, different things are going to matter more, particularly if you have a family.
Yeah, no matter what your personality traits are, the expression of those personality traits is going to depend partly on the situations that you're in. I give the example with my students that, you know, you may know somebody who's very extroverted and somebody else who's extremely introverted. Put them at in a funeral service, neither of them is going to be acting wild and crazy. Put them on a cruise ship, they both might be. And so the situation matters a lot too.
Yeah. Quickly, let me introduce again the guest. We're speaking with Jeffrey Mondak. He's professor of political science here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's interested in political psychology. And the thing that he's done a lot of work and research on is this question, well, is there some sort of connection between an individual's personality and that person's approach to politics, whether they're going to be involved or not? Where it is they'll place themselves on the political spectrum, and it's his argument that in fact, that does operate there, in spite of the fact that maybe some other political scientists would say, well, that doesn't have anything to do with psychology. You'd like to read more on the subject? He's author of the book Personality and the Foundations of Political Behavior, published by the Cambridge University Press. Questions welcome 2-333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I would guess that maybe some people would, maybe if, particularly if you were in the business of politics, you might find this a little distressing because it starts to sound like, you know, politics is all about really about persuasion. And that would make it sound as if it almost doesn't matter that that people are going to, you know, chances are they're going to be Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, you know, whatever, and persuasion doesn't much enter into it.
Well, 2 points about that. One point is that a lot of people, if there is a personality basis to where they align themselves, say, ideologically, their personality traits influence a tendency to be centrist, which means that they're in that middle category where they are more susceptible to persuasion because they could go either way. So, for example, I find that openness to experience tends to be related to being liberal and conscientiousness tends to be related to being conservative. Well, if you are both open to experience and conscientious, you're going to end up probably on the basis of personality somewhere in the middle, and you're the person who may be susceptible to influence by things like political campaigns. Second point is that you made this point earlier. There is no determinism here. We're talking about general tendencies. And so you have a general tendency to lean this way or that. But certainly the messages to which you're exposed in the situations where you find yourself also make a lot of difference.
But there is a sense in which it sounds as if you're saying, yeah, there are some liberals, some conservatives, and maybe also some independents something that's a tendency that's fairly deep within them.
Yeah, that's right. And think about it. There are people who we all know who are so strongly liberal or so strongly conservative that no matter what you say to them, they're not going to change their mind. They can rationalize away anything. And you know, why are those preferences so strongly embedded in those individuals? Well, part of it may be that it's not all about information. Part of it may be that they have some physical, biologically based tendency rooted in personality that inclines them in those directions.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you talk a little bit more about, say, personality traits that tend to align with, let's just, we'll take the extremes of the political spectrum. I mean, things that really tend to line up with a person being quote-unquote liberal and quote-unquote conservative.
I had this conversation recently with a political scientist at Berkeley, and he kind of laughed and he said, "Well, Jeff, all you're doing is confirming people's stereotypes, and there's something to this." And so four of the five personality traits that I study, all of them except extroversion, do tend to predict ideology. If you are high in openness to experience, you're willing to try absolutely anything, you're more likely to be liberal. If you are low in conscientiousness, you're always late, your office is a mess, you can't be trusted to do things, you're more likely to be liberal. If you are very agreeable, you're warm, friendly, polite with people, more likely to be liberal. If you're a real worrier, you're somebody who's kind of neurotic, you fret about everything, more likely to be liberal. So what are we left with? We're left with liberals are open to experience and agreeable, sounds good, and irresponsible and neurotic, sounds not so good. And conservatives are precisely the opposite.
Does any of this help to see one of the things that I think that people are really concerned about is that there seem to be a lot of people that are really alienated from politics. They say, you know, either they say they don't care or possibly they say whatever I do doesn't matter. And so they're not engaged. They're not paying attention. They probably won't vote at all. And, you know, that's not the ideal. We would like to have people engaged. Does this help to explain why it is some people are just don't want to have anything to do with politics?
I think it does. And it's a good example of an interaction between the personality trait and the circumstance. One of the things that I have found in several different studies, and part of it's reported in the book, is that people who are high in conscientiousness are very interested in getting involved in politics if they think their voice will matter. But if they conclude their voice won't matter, well, they're conscientious. They're serious about their families. They're serious about their jobs. And they're willing to not get involved in politics at that point because it's not worth their time to do so. And so one of the differences that I find among conscientious people is that conscientiousness, if the person is high in conscientiousness and is concerned about problems in politics about that person's voice not being heard. He or she doesn't participate. Conversely, when called for jury duty, the people who show up the most for jury duty are the ones who are high in conscientiousness. Why would that be? It's because, in part, they know their voice will matter there. They're going to be on a jury where they're one of six or one of 12 people. They know that they're going to be influential there. Plus, it's in the name. It's a duty. It's an obligation of citizenship. And so they show up. And so if we can convince people that, yes, the system really will be attentive to them, yes, their voice really does matter, I would predict that you would see an uptick in participation levels among people who currently are conscientious and disaffected.
Mm-hmm. That seems like, given politics today, that seems like a pretty tough sell.
Sure.
Yeah. Does this also – is there something here – for people who design and run campaigns, that they could, if you take the perspective of someone who is trying to persuade, I'm trying to get you to vote for my candidate. Is there something here for that?
Yeah, I have a graduate student who's been looking at that question. He's especially interested in mobilization efforts on the part of parties and on the part of community activists. And one of the things that he finds is that people who are a little bit introverted are more likely to sit out an election. But if you contact them face to face, if you go up and ring the doorbell and talk to them, that's the person who you can persuade to actually show up and participate. Another thing that we think is that for an activist trying to get people involved in, say, a community project, it's perilous to take a one-size-fits-all approach. You don't ring everybody's doorbell and say, we're having a rally next Saturday, please show up, because some people will never go to a rally. It's not in their character to do so. But they might be perfectly willing to sit in the back room stuffing envelopes and writing letters to the editor, writing letters to political leaders. And so if you can gauge what the personality-based preferences are of the individual, I think it would be better for the organization and better for the citizen. We can engage more people by finding those aspects of political engagement that fit their psychological profiles.
Mm-hmm. That, I think it's interesting that you could find an individual who really could be really passionate about politics and about issues, and that there are certain things that they would be really willing to do, and yet one thing that they would not do is that they're not going to be the ones to come down to the rally. They're not going to do something that public, but that there would be other things that they would be and could be other important things that they would be perfectly willing to do. So it's not that they're not willing and that they're not engaged, but that the channel that their engagement wants to go down, that's there's going to be a big difference.
Yeah, I helped coach my son's baseball teams for several years. And one of the things you learn, some players are better than others, but all of them are good at something, and you need to find the right position for the player. And so, you may have one kid with a really strong arm, or you may have another kid who runs really fast. You find what works for them. Well, that works for personality too. We will bring the most benefit to the citizen in terms of the benefits of citizen engagement and the most benefit to whatever the organization is if we find which aspect of engagement works best for that person. And personality is very influential in helping us sort through that.
Mm. We're just about midway through this part of Focus, and just let me again introduce our guest, Jeffrey Mondak. He's the James Benson Chair in Public Issues and Civic Leadership in the Department of Political Science at the U of I, and he's interested in political psychology, what it is that you can learn about people's when you learn about people's personality, what then you also can learn about their political orientation. And he says that indeed he thinks that there is reason to believe that personality does influence political behavior. I mean, not the only thing, but it does have an important influence on political behavior. And if you're interested in reading some of his work and research, look for the book Personality and the Foundations of Political Behavior. It is published by the Cambridge University Press. What was it that got you interested in having this be a major focus of your research?
I had done earlier in my career social psychological work, but I hadn't done personality-based work. And it was back in 1996 or 1997, one of these reports came out about Americans not knowing very much about politics. And I stepped back. I had always heard these and thought, okay, Americans don't know much about politics. And then I stepped back and I thought, well, how do we know that? How do we know that they don't know much? And one of the things that I very quickly found was that we were asking these quiz-like questions on surveys where we were practically pleading with the respondents to say, I don't know. And I then read into some literature on educational testing, and for nearly a century now, scholars in educational testing have said, don't do that. Don't plead with people to say, I don't know, because if you do, you'll pick up their personality traits. Some people are prone to like to guess, and some people are prone to not like to guess. And if you encourage people to say, I don't know, you tap the personality-based difference in guessing. And one of the things I found in an early report, there's this long-standing claim that men know a lot more about politics than women do. And I found that 50% of the supposed knowledge gap is just a pure illusion. It's nothing but the consequence of the fact that men like to guess characteristically more than women do. And so when you tell people on a survey, please say, I don't know, women more often than men will say, I don't know. It suppresses their observed knowledge level, but it's not real at all. Well, that got me interested in whether if personality mattered for patterns in how people answer survey questions, maybe it mattered for other aspects of political behavior.
Mm. See, now I think that that's a fascinating observation because we hear so much about how, generally speaking, people are really poorly informed. And when it comes to some of the big issues of our time. Now, what this makes it sound like more like is that people – it's not exactly that they're poorly informed, but that they know that these are really complicated issues. And maybe if you're asking questions like, well, what do you think we should do? Or maybe even what do you think the problem is? That it's not that they have no idea, but that maybe sometimes they're just kind of overwhelmed by the whole thing and they honestly don't know. And that, and when they say, I don't know, that doesn't mean I have no opinion. It means here's something that's really complicated and I'm just not really sure what we should do about it. And that those are really two different things.
Sure. And both of them can be operating at the same time for different people. And we would have no way to sort out which is which. Does the person who say, I don't know, say that because that person really doesn't know or because the person can't articulate an answer given the complexity of it? I should say about levels of knowledge that I found that this tendency of people to differ in their guessing rates causes us to underestimate knowledge levels by about 10 or 15%. And so even after you correct for that, the American public doesn't score an A on knowledge tests, but the American public maybe goes from a D plus up to a B minus or so.
Mm. What you this I'm sure that doing the say looking at personality can tell you a lot about a person, an individual. So looking at that person's personality should give you some insight into how that person's going to think about politics and will they be involved and how are they going to be thinking about issues. Can you, though, take this and say something about not just how individuals behave? Does it tell you something about how whole groups of people behave?
Well, actually, if anything, it's really the latter that we are interested in this research. We're trying to find general patterns in behavior. What are the big picture differences across groups of people? And the book came out over the summer, and as a follow up to it, with one of my colleagues, we're now examining the possible impact of personality in 25 nations throughout the Americas, and we have data from 40,000 survey respondents from 25 nations in the Americas. And so we're looking at whether we can explain whether people in Canada and Costa Rica and Venezuela and Belize differ from one another systematically from nation to nation, in part because of characteristic differences in personality traits.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you find that from are you finding that from nation to nation? So I think you know we do talk about national personalities, and when you do that, I always feel well, I got to be a little careful about saying that, but that there are national characteristics that you can say, yes, one nation tends to be a little bit different than another?
We're just getting into the data and just sorting through this. But one of the things that we have found already is that there are these measures of national culture, of what are the attributes of different cultures. And one dimension that some other scholars had developed is the national culture prone to be more individualistic or more communal? And we find with our data that the more collectively extroverted and agreeable the country is, the more communal the country is. So there's a correspondence between our personality trait measures and other scholars' measures of communalism versus individualism as a cultural attribute.
And does that translate into, say, if we're just asking some basic question, talking about voting behavior? So do things like that at least say anything about people and their willingness to, when the vote is taken, show up and vote?
Well, now, we've examined that. I've examined that with multiple data sets from the United States, and then we've also looked at that with some preliminary Latin American data from Uruguay and Venezuela. And yes, we find, for example, that individuals who are the most open to experience and the most extroverted are the most likely to be politically engaged, including showing up and voting.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just and particularly when it comes to that communalism, individualism sort of continuum, whether does that say if people are more communalist, are they also more likely to vote than people who are more on the individualist side?
I don't know the empirical answer to that. And my top of the head answer would be, well, not necessarily, because there could be perfectly good individual-based reasons to vote. It could be that what you have in mind when voting differs as you move from individualism to communalism, but that you vote at the same rates.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here to talk with. In Pasodum, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was curious, because I go back to the Nixon era, and it seems that at that time you could almost say that the Democrats today would be like Republicans, moderate Republicans. And I guess my question would be, does it make any difference how far a party swings one way or the other as far as like your liberalism or conservatism? It seems like that there really isn't a viable liberal party today if you want to just define it as a liberal and conservative, and is that consequently why there are so many people that would be construed as independents today because they really don't have the one or the other? And I'll hang up and listen. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
There's a scholar at the University of North Carolina, James Stimson, who he studies national mood, which is essentially national ideology. And what he finds is that the collective, the nation's aggregate level of score on a liberal conservative scale does kind of wiggle a little bit systematically this way or that over time. And that mood tends to correspond with the elite level changes, the nature of who is getting elected to office, and the nature of the policies that have been produced. And so there is fluidity both at the mass level and at the elite level, certainly.
Is it true? I think we have this idea that there are more people today who call themselves independents than there have been in the past. Is that actually true?
It's not actually true. When you ask people, we typically measure partisan affiliation on surveys using a 7-point scale. And so you have strong Democrat, regular Democrat, independent-leaning Democrat, independent, and then the flip side for Republicans. And so we can measure the number of pure independents or the number of independents, including those who lean toward Democrats and Republicans. And right now, that portion is relatively small. We've seen much larger portions of people calling themselves independents at other periods in time. Another thing that political scientists do is attempt to assess how important is your partisan affiliation as a predictor of your vote. And we're in one of the strongest periods ever, where if you're a Democrat, you're much more likely than has typically been the case over, say, the last several decades. You're much more likely now to vote purely for Democrats, and if you're a Republican, to vote purely for Republicans. And so if anything, we're in a period of strong partisanship right now at the mass level.
Yeah. I suppose I find myself wondering that even that for people who would want to identify themselves as independents, if if you had some way to score them in a way that got away from the labels, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, whether in fact that person who called themselves an independent, you would say, well, really, I can tell you based on, you know, some number of things that you really do have a tendency to lean one way or the other.
Well, one of the things we find is that people who say I'm an independent and then when asked the follow-up question, but do you lean toward the Democrats or Republicans? If they do lean toward the Democrats or Republicans, their behavior is more like a regular Democrat or Republican than it is like a pure independent. So they're thinking of themselves as independents, but they're behaving as partisans.
Yeah. That's just one of the things that I have noticed, and it seems to be more the case this time in the past, and I have talked about this with colleagues, is that if you look at the political messaging, political advertising, and so forth, it doesn't seem to be that anyone is using Democrat and Republican. No, they're not saying what they are. They're not even saying what their opponent is, as if the party is just in a lot of that has just disappeared.
Well, it depends on where you are. There are some areas where, say, the president currently is quite a bit less popular than he is in other areas. And so there, the Republican challenger, for instance, going after a Democratic House incumbent in this year's election, will certainly be trumpeting partisanship and saying, mm-hmm. You know, I'm of the other party. It's time for change. It's time to move away from the president and his party. Other places where it's more of a toss-up, you think about this from the perspective of the candidate. If you take a strong policy stand, a strong partisan stand, you'll be making nearly as many or maybe as many enemies as friends. Conversely, if you say things like, I believe in fiscal responsibility and I'm pro-education and I have a lot of experience, it's very generic and nobody ever comes out and says, I'm pro-crime and anti-education.
Yeah. That's just I think it's really interesting that people seem to want to, even candidates sometimes want to distance themselves from their own parties, as if to say that those, we have such trouble with those labels and what they mean that they almost don't mean anything anymore.
Well, we're seeing this now, and just 4 years ago we saw it then. This year, a lot of Democrats around the country are running by distancing themselves from the Obama administration, from the administration's policies. 2006, we saw precisely the same thing. You know, President Obama is not campaigning on behalf of very many Democrats, not because he's not willing, but because they don't want him to. They're afraid that it will do more harm than good. Likewise, in 2006, George Bush didn't campaign on behalf of very many Republicans because his popularity was racing downward at that point, and Republicans knew that they needed to distance themselves from him if they had any prospect of being reelected.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think we know about politics is that when things are good, the people who happen to be in power at that point get the credit, or they at least like to take credit. And when things are bad, people who are in power at that time get the blame, whether they're not responsible or they're not completely responsible. Is that just sort of a natural thing that people will say, well, whoever happens to be in charge at that moment, if things are bad, it's their fault?
I think it is a natural thing. People tend to look backwards a year or two and try to, or even 4 years, and try to figure out, have things gotten better or have things gotten worse? And it's a very simple rule of thumb, but it's understandable that we use that simple of a rule of thumb because the macroeconomics of it is so complicated. And how do you point to precisely which combination of which features, which policies enacted by which public officials led to the good or the bad that we see? It's very hard to do.
Mm. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. The guest this morning in this hour of focus is Jeff Mondak. He's professor of political science here at the U of I. He's interested in political psychology. He has written a book on this, Personality and the Foundations of Political Behavior, that looks in some detail at his research and explains this approach to studying personality that uses the big five characteristics, and then make some observations about the connection between that and politics and political behavior. So again, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email wilt-talk@illinois.edu. You talked about the fact that there's good reason to believe that basic aspects of people's personalities are set pretty early. And that there also then is this relationship between your personal style, your style of being in the world, and politics. Is it though? And we also talked about the fact that you cannot completely disentangle a person's life experiences. You know, are there more sort of predictable things that you can say about how people's attitudes change along the life course, or is it in fact that really people's attitudes don't change as much as we might think?
Information will matter and circumstances will matter. And so, you know, if somebody goes from being a single college student to somebody who's holding a job and married and has children, that person is going to become more concerned about, say, neighborhood safety, the quality of public education because of the change in life circumstances. Absolutely. But personality still is going to be a force that will generally incline that person to, say, prefer larger or smaller government. And even within individual campaigns, in the moment, we see that there are differences that relate to personality. And I'll give you an example since we're in the heat of a campaign season mm-hmm. now. There's been a lot of debate among political scientists for about 15 years now about whether negative campaign ads that everybody says they dislike, whether negative campaign ads have the effect of getting people more interested and more likely to vote in elections or less interested and less likely to vote. And I took on this question in the book, and one of the results that I find is that it has both effects depending upon what your personality traits are. People who are open to experience shrug off negative advertisements. They don't care that they're negative. They're just interested in what information they can glean from it. So if you're high in openness to experience, you say, wow, if the campaign is that negative, it must be a really important election, and that person becomes more likely to vote. If you are conscientious, or if you're agreeable, or if you're extroverted, you're very socially related, you're perturbed when you see negative advertisements and you become less likely to vote because it's disaffecting for you. You think that politics as a whole has turned negative and you sour on politics because of that ad.
See, that's very interesting because it seems that we get very contradictory evidence and answers when we ask people about negative ads. On the one hand, people say that they hate them, but on the other hand, we're also told by political scientists that these ads are very effective. So it seems to be difficult to sort out. Well, wait a minute, how do people feel? And what's so interesting about this is that it says, well, it's actually very complicated, and that different individuals react in different ways.
Yeah, marketing scholars will tell you that this isn't just about political ads. It's about product ads too, right? The ads that drive people crazy, that they can't stand those ads, are memorable. And so you may be annoyed by that ad, but it sticks in your mind, and then you remember that product when you see it on the shelf. Well, something similar to that happens with political ads. And the bulk of the evidence on negative advertisements shows that exposure to negative advertisements more likely increases voter turnout than decreases it. People aren't happy about the fact that the campaign turned negative, but they also take the message that, wow, this is an important race. I better get out and vote.
Yeah. Are there other things that about this particular campaign season that you have seen that you think are particularly interesting?
One of the things that strikes me is how much uncertainty there remains. And so we have this pretty clear sense that the Republicans are going to make gains nationally in terms mm-hmm. of the number of House seats they hold, the number of Senate seats they hold, but the people who are predicting this, they have huge margins of error on these predictions. And I think the reason for that, if I were to try to put my finger on the reason for that, I would say that a lot of Americans are unhappy. They're concerned about the economy and they're unhappy with how things have gone under the last 2 years with the Obama administration. But they also have in the back of their minds a lot of lingering doubts about Republicans and whether they would do anything better. And so I think a lot of people are in the okay, which party will screw things up less? Which party truly is the lesser of the two evils here? And it's, there doesn't seem to be a strong preference on the part of these undecided voters. There's no strong preference where they think, wow, I have two great choices. Instead, it's more likely to be, I have two choices. I'm not really comfortable with either, but I guess I'll have to ultimately pick one.
Yeah. I think I've also heard a similar kind of analysis that says early on in the campaign, if we have a lot of people undecided, it's probably because they don't feel that they have enough information to go on to make a decision. But if you get a week away from the election and you still have a lot of people undecided, what that tells you is that people are really unhappy about the choices that they've been presented with.
Yeah, and I think that we are seeing that this year nationally. And then you know, the other part of the indecision is that a lot of these races are razor thin. You look to 8 to 10 Senate seats and 50 or 60 House seats where the surveys continue to come out within the margins of error. And so they really are virtual toss-ups.
Mm-hmm. With as much experience as we've got in polling now, why does it seem that if anything, as time goes along, your reservations about poll results seem to get bigger all the time? You say, well, okay, this is what the polls say, but I'm not sure how much faith I want to put in it.
Well, the tricky part with pre-election polls is accurately forecasting which people will vote. This year's elections are going to be won and lost by how many people show up and vote and which party does the better job of mobilizing its voters. And that's very hard to project if you're a pollster. You can create a snapshot of what everybody in the district or what you think likely voters in the districts, what their preferences are. But if you're off by 10 or 15% on how many people vote and the people who show up are disproportionately in favor of one party rather than the other, your whole poll falls apart.
Well, do many polls make that distinction between just anybody and what they think and trying to determine who are the likely voters and what they think?
They do. Virtually all of the pre-election polls now try to impose some metric where they determine who the likely voters will be. They have different metrics and they have different guesses. And if we have 30 or 40 or 50% turnout in an election, those differences make a whole lot of difference because that extra 10 or 20% of people who vote in an election may lean strongly toward one party rather than the other.
Is it the case that still a lot of this polling is being done by telephone?
There is still a lot of telephone, but there's also more internet-based polling too.
Okay. I think about the case of the telephone that I'm sure that there are some people who just won't respond. But also there has been now for some time this question about do you get at the growing number of people who have mobile phones? And so what you're doing is you're just calling landlines and you're getting anybody who actually is willing to talk with you.
Right. If you were to run a survey just with landlines, you would have a much older respondent base than would be a truly representative sample. You can weight the data and try to account for that in various manners. Better typically will be to try to get at mobile phones, and also people are making very good, very effective use of internet-based surveys now.
Yeah, but that still is only going to get you the people who have an internet presence.
Yeah, that's a pretty high portion, especially when you're talking about the sorts of people who vote in midterm congressional elections.
Mm-hmm. Back to the question of turnout, that's really the issue, I guess. It comes down to the fact that you win elections by getting your voters to turn out, and I suppose that there are some people also would say you win elections by doing what you can to get the other candidates' voters not to turn out, whether that's maybe a more difficult business. Are there, though, again, things that you can do based on what it is you know about people that can actually convince them that it's important for them to go and vote?
Yeah, I talked to a person who was in 2006 working for the Republican Party and trying to get Republicans to vote, even though they were pretty unhappy with the Iraq War and very unhappy with the Bush administration and leaning against voting. And this person knew which buttons to push for the given individual. So suppose it's an individual who is very strongly in favor of gun rights and that's an extremely important issue to that person. He can call on the phone or he can send a message to this person and say, hey, look, I'm with you. I understand why you're not happy with the war. I understand why you're not happy with the president. But if we want to protect gun rights, you need to vote Republican. We need you to show up and vote. And so they can figure out which message works for the individual. Then they can mobilize people. It's called micro-targeting. They can mobilize people on almost a household-by-household basis. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. Well, that I suppose it gets to the criticism that says that single issues have become so important and that there are people that are moved by one thing more than anything else. Is that really the case? Is it more the case now than it's been in the past?
There will always be some people who have one or two issues that are more important to them than are the bulk of issues. But when you look at the American public as a whole, this year, for instance, this is an election about the economy. 2006 was largely an election about the war in Iraq. And so there can be a single overarching issue that influences the mindsets of large portions of the electorate, even while there are pockets of voters who gravitate toward other issues at the same time.
Coming down to a couple of minutes here, we do have a caller in Champaign. Let's talk with them on line one. Hello.
Yes, this is fascinating. What about how voters' psychology is affected by something I haven't heard you talk about, and that is all these negative ads, I think, have been spawned by the Citizens United versus FEC case. And not only is there money flooding into Illinois in the Senate race, I'm certain, but also money coming from people that are anonymous. And all of these negative ads, and you do say they are effective, how does this flood of money all over the political, in the political system affect the personality attitudes of voters and also the nature of civil discourse in our elections, and do they undermine our sense of political democracy?
Well, I'm not a scholar of campaign finance, and so I'm with you in being intrigued and curious about the role of the changing base of campaign financing. The one point I can offer that may bring a little bit of comfort is that people are pretty good about being on the sort of cognitive defense when they know that they're watching an ad. We don't see ads and just lap it up and buy whatever is in the advertisement. Instead, we're aware that we're watching an ad and that we know somebody's trying to sell us something. And so our guard tends to be up a little bit.
Well, the reason I asked that about the Senate race, I was reading an article in the Chicago Tribune that said the election seemed to be trending against Alexei Gianoulis because of a flurry of negative ads against him from the Kirk campaign. And, of course, that disheartened me. Do you think that's possible, or they just made a generalization in the Chicago Tribune that was totally baseless?
We have there a possible cause and we have an effect. And what they're doing in that article is saying that since there were more ads and we see a little bit of movement in the polls, it must be the ads that made the difference. I'm more hesitant about claiming that we've identified a true cause and effect relationship than that. It could be that the ads are mattering, but we would have to test that much more systematically.
I read on the front page of the USA Today that there's a 26, based on a poll the USA did with somebody, there's a 26-point difference between Democrats and Republicans in terms of enthusiasm gap. How do you go about measuring such a difference in enthusiasm gap?
Well, the reason for the difference in enthusiasm, I think, is that the Obama campaign in 2008 did a very good job of sparking enthusiasm among many people who had not previously voted or who were more peripherally attached to politics. And then those same people now, 2 years later, are looking at 9.5% unemployment and looking at things that are sort of stagnant, and they just naturally don't have the enthusiasm that they did 2 years ago. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, Republicans have been very vocal about their plans, the candidates, their plans to revert back and undo some of the policy changes that we've seen, and they've been quite effective in sparking enthusiasm among their constituents.
All right, thank you, Professor. Right.
Well, there we are just about at the place we're going to have to finish. You think truly that I wonder if there is so much negative advertising, if it gets to the point where people just don't believe that they're ever being given a straight message. You think, though, actually people are looking at the messages more carefully than that and asking, well, is there something here that's important?
People try to take out factual information. They try to actually acquire facts from ads, but they're pretty good about if somebody is spinning the information this way or that, people are pretty good about being attentive to alert to that and staying on guard.
Mm-hmm. Well, at that, we're going to have to finish up. We're here at the end of the time. And certainly, if you'd like to read a little bit more on the subject, personality and political behavior, you can look for the book that I've mentioned a couple times by our guest, Jeff Mondak. The book is Personality and the Foundations of Political Behavior. It's published by the Cambridge University Press. Our guest, Jeffrey Mondak, is James Benson Chair in Public Issues and Civic Leadership in the Department of Political Science here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, presenting Extraordinary Voices on Saturday, November 5th at 7:30 p.m. in the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Baritone Ricardo Herrera joins Sinfonia in a celebration of the works of William Schumann. More information is available at 333-6280.
And that's it for us on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 7.35¾. That contract is up 14. March, 7.52, up 14¾. In Chicago, December wheat, 6.92, up 18. March, 7.30¼, up 18. December corn, 5.73, up 4¼. March, 5.85½, up 4. May, 5.91¾, up 4½. July, 5.95½, up 4¾. November beans, 12.21½, up 3¾. January, 12.32¾, up 2¾. March, 12.39½, up 2¼. May,